Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, restaurateurs, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. Today, we have live in studio Chef Carla Hall, entrepreneur, star of The Chew on ABC, who's about to open her hot chicken restaurant, Southern Kitchen, in New York City next year. So we're going to talk how this accountant turned model, fashion model, turned lunch caterer, ended up on TV. And it wasn't an easy path. Because at the age of 40, she found herself in tears, on her knees, in the shower. And plus, we'll chat hamburgers, high school, and match.com. But first, we have on the line Adrienne Moore, hotel concierge at the Mandarin Oriental Paris, and the author of Inside Chef's Fridges, the book that gives you the insider, literally, peek into what they call the kitchen underwear drawer of chefs like Marco Pierre White, Otto Lange, Fergus Henderson, and Massimo Bottura. Hey, Adrienne.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
How are you, Leyte?
So good. I'm super excited to have you on because your book is like one of those, the epitome of like the idea that I wish I had, because it's so brilliant. Like, what a way to peek into these chefs' souls. I mean, it's like the food version of, you know, that one, they have that one blog called The Covateur, which goes into the closets, yep, of like musicians and fashion folks. So when you and your co-author, Carrie, the photographer, yep, when you were writing the book, you went on so many adventures. And of all of these adventures, what was the most memorable?
Oh, God, there were so many. I mean, you know, we were dealing with 40 different of the best chefs in Europe. Each one was a very unique personality, and every visit was amazing. But I would say one of the chefs who really, really impressed us was Marco Pierre White, you know, who was the youngest three-star Michelin chef of his time, and who was the first chef who sort of decided to give back his three Michelin stars to, you know, to Michelin Guide, in order to have a normal life, more or less. And he invited us to his Wiltshire country home, which is a gorgeous art-filled sort of home not far from Salisbury. I guess, you know, having a full English breakfast with him and then spending the rest of the rainy day hunting pheasant and woodcock with him, it was pretty insane, huh?
Wow. Okay. So is he as much of a bad boy as we all, you know, imagine him to be?
Oh, he's a total, I mean, I think he was one of a handful of chefs who we knew were in the presence of genius. I mean, he had such a force of character and he was such a powerful person. It was really, I mean, you don't meet many people like that. I mean, the other person who was quite like that was Massimo Bottura, who's number one on the 50 best list and long considered to be one of the best chefs in Italy. We spent the day in his enormous compounds in Modena, just talking about food and life and eating simple risotto. I mean, that was another great moment.
So what is Marco Pierre White?
They were all great in each in their own way.
What does Marco Pierre White keep in his fridge?
Nothing. Funny enough, I mean, it's the only fridge picture that is empty. He has his gorgeous 1930 French fridge from the Fridge Co. Company, I think, which later became Thompson. It is the most beautiful. It used to be an icebox, and he had it modernized at great expense and turned into a modern fridge. But as he sort of spends not a lot of time in his weekend house for the moment, because I think he was still working on it, most of the stuff belonged to his staff that was in the fridge. So he said, yeah, I just empty out the fridge and take a picture of his fridge. And he's so proud of it. I mean, his house is full of art, even up until his fridge. I mean, his fridge was a work of art.
Weirdest ingredients.
In Michael Pierre White's fridge?
Just in general that you encountered.
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's what I found very interesting was the high and the low. So, I mean, with all chefs, they all had supermarket products. I mean, everybody had ketchup. Everybody had French mustard. Everybody had more or less some sort of industrial cheese, Asian condiments. I mean, they all had, very few fridges were like 100% organic and, you know, from the garden. But, you know, there's a lot of vegetables. There was not a lot of protein, you know, not a lot of meat, although with some notable exceptions of chefs who had lots of meat. But they all of them tend to have sort of the high-end niche products, and a lot of them probably came from producer friends or from their refrigerators at work. And then the other stuff was just, supermarket fare that any hard-working person needs in the fridge, you know?
So chefs, they're just like us. We could do like an OK magazine,
yeah,
a People magazine spread.
Pretty much. But then the thing is, when you see them working at home, and I mean, you know, they can leave their job at home, but these are very, very highly trained and very intelligent, creative people in the kitchen. And they could, you know, they can take a tomato, an apple, and some herbs and just, like, make an insane dish out of it. I mean, you know, one chef of note, Inaki Espitalt, who is the chef of the world-renowned Chateaubriand, which I think is 21st on the 50 best list, we went to his place and he had nothing in the fridge. Out of his bedroom came stumbled out a Mexican chef friend, obviously they partied the night before. So he got out like an egg, some takis, some spicy takis, corn chips, and some like Thai basil and capers, and made just this most amazing dish out of it. And it's just stuff he found on the spur of the moment, you know?
So tell me about...
It's easy to say these people have like just like us in the fridge, but afterwards when they put their mind and technique to it, they can do fantastic stuff.
Well, tell me about the frozen ortolans.
Yeah, well, ortolans, I mean, used to be, they're part of the French tradition, and they're a very, very luxurious dish. And back in the day, I mean, maybe 50 years ago, there's a whole ceremony around it, you know, dipping the birds. They're very small birds, similar to a hummingbird, and they're dipped in Armagnac and then cooked and eaten whole. They're very fatty birds, so you eat the bones, you eat everything all together, and apparently it's one of the most amazing gastronomic experiences in the world. And even President Chirac on his deathbed asked for this as his last meal. And one of our chefs, Yves Condebord, who's of the Comptoir, Ouvrier de Comptoir, a very well-known French chef, had a little bag of these frozen stuck away in the corner of his freezer. That was pretty amazing.
We'll have to... I'm going to make fun of Christian Polisi the next time I see him and ask him how old that old birthday cake really was.
Yeah, no, he was a great guy. Well, he was amazing. He's one
nice
of the nicest chefs ever.
It's nice to know.
The chefs were so nice. I mean... Christian Bobeck, especially, he's in New York now doing his...
Yeah, I'm going to his pop-up dinner this Sunday.
He was the most insane guy we met. I mean, we set up in his house in Copenhagen, and the whole time he's like, I haven't got time, I've got a date afterwards, or I've got a meeting afterwards. And then he just kept pushing it off and pushing off, and then we ended up staying out like super late, going out drinking and eating until like I don't know what time in the morning, and then meet up with him for lunch the next day. He was the most amazing guy. I mean, really, really far out there.
So this was Toshin's first food book, and in fact, yeah. You mentioned that Mr. Toshin didn't formally believe in cookbooks. So
no, that's a rumor.
What is this saying about like food and media today?
As you know, chef and restaurant culture is gone with the internet and with all social media sort of networks. it's going quicker and quicker. And people know and they want to know more about what's going on in the restaurant world. They're more aware than what's going on from ever before. I guess you could ask, does this mean is Tashin finally catching on to this culture? But I'm not so sure that's it. I think that basically we came up with the right idea at the right time. And Tashin's all about sort of a global appeal and finding great ideas. So, I mean, when we came up with this, and I did with Carrie Solomon, you know, my co-author, photographer, we just came up with a great idea. I think we proved to them that we had pretty deep contacts in the chef world, and they believed in us to make it work. So, I mean, lots of people talk about Benedict Tashin as being this this great visionary. You know, he's done so many insane books. And I really believe in it. You know, without putting myself up on a pedestal, he was the only publisher who really stepped in and wanted to do our idea exactly as we wanted to do it. And the results we're really happy with.
Who is the most difficult chef to get?
Difficult? I mean, they're all, to a certain level, all of the well-known chefs are really difficult to get a hold of. I mean, I would say Marco Pierre White, probably, because I got him through a friend who's actually someone who's quite powerful in London, a wealthy, influential man who knows him very well, is a personal friend, and he's also a personal friend of mine. So without him, we never would have gotten Marco Pierre White. And it was him who said, do it, definitely do it, do Marco. You know, he hasn't even got email. He's got this old, sort of Nokia vintage phone. It doesn't even text, almost. So, you know, we call him from France because we're both based in France, and he'd see the number and he wouldn't answer because he didn't recognize the number. Quite interesting. And then you've got chefs like Inaki, who are like, you know, he's like the wonder child poster boy, you know, chef in Paris. And he doesn't do email, and he, you know, he never answers his phone, he never answers text, so it's
My last question.
Funny.
My last question.
And then you've got people who are actually difficult to get to, like Magnus Nilsson at Fabriken. I mean, he was way up in the north of Sweden that we got caught in a snowstorm on the way up there. And then, for example, chefs like Sebastian Bras, who has 3 Michelin stars. He's like deep in the heart of the Aveyron region of France. I mean, takes it. Some of these places are a bit far flung.
I love it. It's the project of a lifetime.
We did it for free, you know, it would have been worth it, you know, it's amazing, you know, when we started getting into it, it's just like, next chef, what's going to be in it, what are they going to be like, you know, and it was mind-blowing, I mean, yeah, a great project.
My last question for you, Adrian, you're now known as the chef fridge guy, I bet, at cocktail parties. So would you be embarrassed if I came over unannounced and popped my head into your fridge, like, right now?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's funny because, you know, it's, a lot of people say, oh, you can't just, like, surprise people. But the thing is, we really, the only reason that the fridges would have been rearranged a little bit inside would have been for aesthetic reasons. I mean, you know, we'd move a few things around. Some chefs didn't want to give free advertising to, like, you know, certain ketchup brands or, you know, things like that. But the only reason, we did very little tinkering in the fridge. They're pretty much as we found them. And a lot of people say, oh, well, the chefs are rearranging fridges before you got there, and, you know, you can't know. But, you know, even if they did, I mean, it still gives clues to their personality, you know. I mean, if a chef's, like, doing something, like, really, really, super arranged and well-organized, then it gives, you know, sort of gives a hint to his personality.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's great talking to you.
Get Inside Chef's Fridges on Amazon.com and find her booksellers everywhere. I've got lots of Naughty and Nice, Voyeuristic, and Hungry People on my list this year. And after this quick commercial break, we will return with Chef Carla Hall of The Chew. Stay tuned.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer. And trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You know, every Tuesday at 3 p.m., I stop in the studio, walk to the far side, sit in my favorite blue chair. If you ever stop by Roberta's, look through the window, and you can see that chair itself. You know, and I've been sitting here for 5+ years, 250 episodes, have met some of the best people in the food world, such great culinary minds. And recently we just relaunched our website, added a whole bunch of shows, but we still need you, our listeners, our friends, our fans, even guests themselves, to help us out. We're a 501c3, a nonprofit, and we're not really doing this for the money. We're doing this for the love, for the greater good of the food world as a whole. So get on heritageradionetwork.org, click that little pounding heart in the top right corner, and you know, give what you can, or just keep on listening. We'd love to have you.
Back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leitihsu. That's L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U. We're at Heritage_Radio, nonprofit food radio. Woo! And we are hashtag talk to us WOM show, short for Word of Mouth Show. Stay in touch by signing up for my weekly food letter, the never-ending search for the best, newest deliciousness worldwide at wordofmouth.fm, and hit subscribe and listen to the show anytime, anywhere through iTunes or Stitcher. And today, live in studio, we are so lucky and excited to have Chef Carla Hall, entrepreneur, star of The Chew, and she's about to open her hot chicken restaurant, Southern Kitchen, in New York City. Welcome, Carla.
Hi, Lacey. It's great to be here. This is my first time to Roberta's.
Really?
My first time, and I can't believe how busy it is at like 2:20 in the afternoon. Wow.
Wow.
Okay, divine order for my restaurant.
And thank you so much for schlepping to Brooklyn in between wrapping up your taping of The Chew, and then you're going back for the holiday party, right?
Yes, I'm committed. Yes, I am.
So how does The Chew celebrate, do a holiday party?
We do a holiday party at Lucky Strike, and so it's bowling, dancing, we have a DJ, we bowl, they have food, and we just sort of get to thank everybody who is a part of the show.
So you just wrote a little something for your wall. That is your real wall in the new restaurant, not
yes.
Our virtual Facebook walls, which I couldn't wrap my head around.
I know. I was saying, oh, lady, do you want to hear the love letter that I wrote to Nash? It's on my wall. And you're like, your Facebook wall? No, like a real wall.
Okay, let's hear it.
So this is the restaurant, Carla Hall Southern Kitchen, is a love letter to Nashville, which is where I am from. Ooh. And so we had the idea to actually write that love letter that I would write to Nashville. And so here it is. And nobody's heard this. And hopefully I'll read the right version. Okay. Dear Nashville, I remember the first time I introduced myself as being from Nashville, Tennessee, home of the Grand Ole Opry and the Titans, in one long breath, and it just stuck. I may have had to leave you to live in other cities, but as far as I'm concerned, I can only be from one place. You helped to lay my foundation, my Southern sensibilities, the friendliness I have towards strangers, my love of meat and threes and fried fish sandwiches, good music, both R&B and country, and the twang in my accent that comes and goes. I'd be lying if I didn't admit that I wanted to leave you after I graduated from high school, but that distance has made me appreciate you all the more. I miss sitting at a green light for two beats before stepping on the gas. Why? Because life should be enjoyed, not rushed. I miss being welcomed everywhere by long, drawn-out greetings of, "Can I help you?" Because it always comes with the promise of a good conversation. Because of you, I love all Southern accents. I honk at Tennessee license plates, and I crave cool, sweet tea on all days, hot and cold. If I forget to tell you enough, please know that I carry you wherever I go. Carla Hall's Southern Kitchen may have opened in 2016, but it's been in the making for over 50 years. This restaurant, my dearest Nashville, is your living love letter. Hugs and spices, Carla.
Woo! Carla Hall, the wordsmith.
Oh my God! Snap! Snap. Okay, wait, can I get some snaps? What?
So, you love words, and in fact, etymology, wordplay, as something that you and your husband Matthew and Clinton Kelly all share in common.
There is nothing sexier to me than someone who can conjugate a verb and who can speak appropriately and speaks correctly. I think when people say between you and I cringe because it is wrong, people. It is wrong. When you cannot distinguish the possessive your, Y-O-U-R, and the contraction you are, your, apostrophe R-E. I'm like, seriously, people? And honestly, I think it's because I'm from Nashville and because I do have an accent, because your possessive mm-hmm. is your, like mm-hmm. your book. Mm-hmm. But when you say you are going to the store, you're going to the store, you're. Because, I mean, it's different. It's my accent. Okay. My accent doesn't make them the same.
So, speaking of words, you got your dress and everything for your wedding, including your husband, online.
Yeah.
So, that's actually, you know, very cute because I feel the same way. Like,
yes.
The folks who write to me in proper English, it's just so hot and sexy.
It's so, oh my God, it's so sexy.
So how did you and Matthew meet?
So, Matthew and I met on Match.com and, so yes, he was online and he was upset because Match had charged him for another month, right? And he was like, ah! And so they're like, look, we're not going to give you your money back, but you may as well use it for this last month. So he said, okay, fine. I'm going to change everything. I'm going to do the exact opposite from what I've done in the previous month. So he said, okay, 5'10 or taller. He was doing short girls, not doing them, but, you know, going out with, oh, wow, going out with short girls. Never been married. 5'10 or taller. And so what else did he say? There was one other thing. But anyway, everything was the exact opposite. And then I popped up, and it was the first day that I went on Match.
Wow.
And so we met sort of that first. He was the second person the first person actually who not just winked, but, you know, sent this long tome. And then we met physically a week later, and that was it. I got off.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And do you remember any like bits from the piece of writing that he sent you?
Well, I know one of the things that he said, it was all about communication. And he talked
so
about,
sexy.
I know, so sexy. What communication? And he wanted somebody who could go to a hoedown and also a black tie and not be embarrassed.
I love
so,
it.
So, right? So from the, you know, from the rooter to the tutor, from the way right to way left. I mean, you know, just somebody who was flexible in their presentation of wherever they went. So I loved that.
So you're thinking maybe your food genes come from your dad and your grandpa and mm-hmm. a hamburger tradition.
Yes. Well, my dad was a professional waiter, and he worked at the Bellmead Cafeteria, which is kind of a posh place, even though it's a cafeteria in Bellmead. And it's a swanky neighborhood in Nashville. And my grandfather had a five and dime shop, and they had the best sort of deli hamburgers, those greasy burgers with the big soft bun and the onions cooked on the meat, and it was thin and
all the griddle bits.
What? Yes. Yes. So good.
Wow. So a cafeteria, by the way, is like just somewhere where people go get lunch.
A cafeteria, yes. But, you know, if you have been to Nashville, sort of like in these old cafeterias, like Morrison's Cafe, the Bellmead Cafe, you get your tray and then you start with the salads and you're just go down the line and you pick your stuff. And by the time you get to the other end, they ring it up and then the waiter actually picks your tray up, takes it to your table, and then puts it on your table and takes it away. So
I think earlier in the letter you read, you've hinted at what is your actual age, even though your looks belie your actual age. I hope to be you when I grow up. Anyway, so a long time ago, though, you were kind of an unusual bird in high school.
I was the weird kid. I did theater, and I did theater from 12 to 17. My mother put me in theater because I was painfully shy. And I think theater saved me in that I was like, okay, dare to be you, dare to be different. It's kind of cool to be weird.
Yeah.
I had all kinds of misfit friends, and you know, I was okay with being weird. But I went from that weird kid to actually being the prom queen.
Wow.
And I was most likely to succeed. I mean, who'd have thunk? I mean, honestly, I had buck teeth, I had braces, I had these, you know, this big long hair that was just kind of crazy. So Wow.
And did you go to your high school what was the last high school reunion you actually went to?
The last and actually only high school reunion I went to was my 30th.
Okay, because I have one like that's like the 11th, but it's a 40-year anniversary of my high school. So it's like a big deal, but it's not something I would normally do. And I'm like not sure how I feel about it.
You have to go.
Okay.
You have to go.
Perspective on who you once were and who you've become.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, when I went, I was just Carla. I wasn't Carla who's on television. I'm like, I'm just Carla.
But people must have been like, ooh.
I know. I'm like, dude, you knew me back when I was the goofy kid. Okay. But I have to tell you, to go back to your 30th class reunion, sometimes you will see somebody like, oh my God, was Santa Claus in my class? I mean, you see people like totally gray, like all gray hair, gray beard, you know, little belly. I'm like, Santa, hey, dude, I know you were in my class. Yeah.
Oh, very, very appropriate for the season. I haven't made this episode overly holiday-ish, but ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
Hootie.
Hootie ho ho
ho ho ho. So you went on to be an accountant, like a lot of us who start out in professional services, because
yes,
that's what you're supposed to do,
right?
Then you also modeled.
I did. I went from being an accountant after wanting to do theater and go to Boston University, which I did not do. So I majored in accounting because I liked my accounting teacher in high school.
Awesome reason,
right? A teacher. All the teachers out there, shout out to you because you have so much power to impact a child's life. So I went on to Howard University, majored in accounting. And because it's indoctrinated in you to get your CPA to work for a Big Eight accounting firm, that's what I did. And I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I quit after 2 years because I said, I don't want to be 40 and hate my job. Mm-hmm. So I left that. And then I went on to model. I'd been sort of modeling. The jump seems kind of crazy, but I modeled in college at the big fashion shows in college. I modeled when I was in Tampa, Florida. And so I quit my meeting some girls who were modeling. And even though I hadn't passed my CPA exam, I still, even though I wasn't in accounting and I wasn't going back, I still finished taking the exam because
you're a good little Asian.
I'm a good little Asian girl. Yes. I'm a Blasian.
So when you were modeling, you lived and traveled in London, Paris, Milan. Mm-hmm.
Right. So I was sort of going and doing the circuit in where you would go in for the season and you just try to get as many jobs as you can. And I did runway. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was different then. Now there's no difference between the girls who are on the runway and the girls who are in print. But back in the day, in the late 80s, early 90s, there were the show models who were on the runway, and then there were the print models. And the two pretty much didn't cross over. And it was exciting. It was an exciting time.
I dug up some old photos of you, by the way. I was able to, even though it was pre, like, internet. So,
yeah.
Really, really fantastic.
Thank you. I had that look that looks so much like kind of like a 1930s actress.
Yes. That's correct. I'm thinking back. So you were in these great cities of the world, and at that young age, coming from Nashville, like, what did each of these cities, like, mean to you? Like, what was, you're like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time when I was in Milan, and I went to a little kiosk to have pizza, and my friend Rosalind Johnson, who lives in Newark, she and I were getting a piece of pizza, and the guy takes this square of pizza and then cuts it in half with shears. Okay. So here we are on the street, and we're sharing this pizza, and we took a bite. Well, I took a bite, and I'm like, oh my God. It's like at that moment when you realize you haven't really had pizza, you know, really good pizza, and you taste the yeast and the crust, and it was just the right amount of crust, and you had that tomato sauce that was just perfectly acidic, and then you had the cheese and the basil, and it was all like so ooey gooey, and it was so balanced and so delicious. And oh my God, there's pizza in front of me too right now. It's like, oh, I want some pizza.
Perfect. And then what was Paris like?
Paris was all about just this beautiful food that, and all of these desserts and the pâtisserie. When I first got to Paris, I didn't know that much French. I had learned a little bit of French before going over. I knew about 10 words. And my first meal in France, I went down to a pâtisserie, and I go up to the woman. I said, un croissant du beurre, s'il vous plaît. She's like, croissant du beurre. Like, okay. Un croissant du beurre, s'il vous plaît. She's like, un croissant du beurre. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to starve here. I cannot speak. I'm going to starve. And France was sort of like this place to really immerse myself in the culture, but understanding the culture that people do not invite you to their homes unless they really want to bring you into the fold. You could work with somebody who's French for decades and they will never invite you to their home. I mean, it was kind of crazy. But coming from Nashville, where we're like opening our doors and you have dew drop ins, it was very different. So I had to sort of understand that and learn that and just sort of watch the culture from afar. So it was in France that I learned about food and the socialization that takes place in the kitchen. But it was all Americans and we had these big brunches, and that was sort of brought me into the food world and just loving that.
Really? Mm-hmm. It was the models, hashtag models who brunch, contrary to popular belief.
Hashtag models eat. What? Saw them.
Yeah. So you joined in on these model feasts.
Yes. We would have macaroni and cheese and buffalo wings, and we would have greens. Are you kidding me? These girls, I mean, the thing is, we're walking all the time, and they were naturally thin. I don't know what they do now, but they were naturally thin, and we were like chowing down. And there was this woman named Elaine who was from Memphis, Tennessee, and she was a hairstylist, and we would just have, I mean, we only did it once a week, but it was pretty incredible.
At some point, you fell into having a lunch delivery service.
Yes.
You're a cutting edge kind of gal, because this is long before all the startups these days are doing the same. Munchery, Sprig, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. So when I left France, my mother had gotten sick. Oh, no, I'd gone from France to London. So I left there, and I was back in Washington, D.C., where my sister lived. And one of my friends that I lived with in Paris, who was a model, was now working for a doctor's office. And so I had a baby shower for my sister, and I invited this girl, Patrice, and she said, oh, I can't come. I said, well, that's okay. I'll bring you some leftovers. And so the next day, my brother-in-law, whom I was living with my sister, ate all the leftovers. I mean, like, really? Dude, you kind of ate my interview or something. So I made a bunch of stuff. It was just random. It was a lemon blueberry bread. It was biscuits with smoked turkey. I think I had some chess pie, and I may have had another little sandwich. And I'm like, okay. Well, but since I had to cook something, I made like a whole thing of it. So I'm looking around the house. I'm like, what am I going to put it in? And I saw this picnic basket. So I threw everything in the picnic basket. And so I go off and I run to this office. And when I get there, Patrice is like, oh, hey, Carla, I want to introduce you to, I'm working with, you know, to the doctor and everybody. She's like, hey, this is my friend Carla. She has a business. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, what's the name of it? And I'm like, I'm looking at them and I look down at the picnic basket and I say, the lunch basket. And then the next beat is, well, when are you coming back? And I looked at them without hesitation. I said, tomorrow. And so I left there and I went door to door, hair salons, doctor's offices, florist. And within a week, I had 7 clients. Within 2 weeks, I had 14. And I did that for 5 years before going to culinary school at 30.
You mentioned that you realized early on that you didn't want to be 40 and be hating your job. Mm-hmm. And at 40, you were not hating your job, but certainly not everything was figured out. You were working your ass off. You worked 7 years without a break or vacation. And
yep.
One night you find yourself, you know, on your knees in the shower, like breaking down, crying.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I didn't make a lot of money catering. I was sort of just doing this thing and I loved it. And probably people that worked for me got paid more than I did. And I remember doing an event for like a government agency, and they don't pay like really quickly. So I'm like, I needed the money, and all these bills are due, and you know, credit cards are up the wazoo, and I'm in the shower and I am so distraught that I just sort of break down, start crying. I'm on my knees, the water's beating down my back, and I'm like, ugh. And so the next day, I went to my church, which is a metaphysical church. And I think spirituality sort of got me through this space. And I remember, and we used to do a lot of spiritual readings, sort of intuitive readings. Okay, you guys, I'm weird. I've never said that I wasn't. Those of you who judge me, don't judge me. And the minister turned to me and said, Carla, everything's going to be okay. You are going to get through this. And I hadn't said anything about anything that was happening. I guess, you know, in my energy, he was just like, the girl looks down. He said, everything is going to be just fine. You are on the path. You should be doing this. And a couple days later, I got the check. And even to this very day, when things are really trying and I don't have the money for something, and I'm like, okay, let me remember those times when I thought I had to quit. I thought I was supposed to get out and exit stage left, and then a confirmation would come about with money or whatever, somebody saying something. And that's true to this very day.
So it was a ziggy zaggy route.
Yes.
To being on TV. It just didn't just happen overnight. How did you end up on The Chew?
You know, I think people think that things just happen, and my life started with Top Chef, which was only 7 years ago, and I've been doing this, you know, since I was 25, and, you know, 21 years since culinary school. Like everything in my life, from my husband to Top Chef, when I got on The Chew, it was just like that. It was like the universe placed this on my plate and said, here you go. I had gone through the first interview. They didn't call me, and then they shot the pilot, and then they said, okay, we're going to change the cast. And I went in for a chemistry test with Mario, Michael Simon, Clinton Kelly, and Daphne Oz. There were other people that we saw as well, but the five of us were only together for 20 minutes before deciding that we were the cast. And 6 days later, they announced us as the cast.
Wow.
And I said at that moment, I'm supposed to be doing something with this. There's no way that the universe gives you something like this and you're like, okay, what am I supposed to do with it? And at that point, my prayer was authenticity. And it took me a minute to get to it, to feel comfortable enough with myself to actually show my authentic self on television when you have all these other things going on. But it really is about, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to show people that you are who you are, whether you like me or not. Therefore, the people that you can like. But I'm going to be me every single day I show up on that set.
And what's funny is that it came out of a potential show on Travel Channel that didn't end up working out.
Exactly right. I mean, we were in So I was in negotiations with this show for Travel Channel for about 6 months, and my attorney kept saying, it's a bad deal, don't take it. I'm like, oh, well, that's okay. You know, once I get my feet wet and something else will come into this. He's like, no, it's a bad deal. And it turned out, I would have signed it, but Scripps bought Travel Channel, and then the deal just went kaput, and nothing happened, and a year later, the chew came. So honestly, if I had signed the deal with Travel Channel, I wouldn't have been available for
wow.
the chew.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Wow. So you still have the same attorney now, right?
Yeah, still have it.
You told me that your confidence needed like 2 years to catch up
yes.
when you're on the chew. And so what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, a lot of people think, okay, you were on Top Chef, so you've done television. But the thing is, on Top Chef, you are doing what you do, and there's a camera catching it. And, you know, so you're not really posing for the camera. You're not scripted. But on the chew, I had to do a segment in 5 minutes. So not in that segment, I have to make a dish. I have to talk to people. I have to get something across to the audience about myself so they feel connected. I may have to even interview somebody in that segment. So in 5 minutes. And people don't realize how hard that is.
Yeah.
And if somebody is making it look easy, they're really good at what they do. I mean, pretty much 9 people out of 10 cannot do it. And that's why people seem so stiff and you're, you know, getting your beats and timing together. So it was really hard. And I was really hard on myself because I love teaching cooking classes. And I'm like, why is it that I can stand up here, teach a cooking class, and it goes flawlessly, but I can't bring that same energy and confidence to the show? Mm-hmm. And so it was really, really hard. As a matter of fact, when I had my first apartment, when I first came up here for the chew, it was a furnished apartment. I'm talking furnished with dishes, flatware, plates, and I refused to get my own place because if I got fired, I needed to move in like 60 minutes or less.
And by the way, the fact that we just went through 20 questions in like 30 minutes flat, that was really magical. I'm counting you guys. It's a little bit insider look at what it's like to do a live show. Like, go you.
Yeah.
So you, Carla, you're, you know, black woman on mainstream American TV. Mm-hmm. And you're now so proud to be you, your real authentic self. And there might have been a time when you were just running away from what I kind of started to call like a fried chicken identity.
Yeah, but it actually just that. When I had left culinary school, I sort of didn't want to be known as Carla the Southern Cook. I didn't want to be pigeonholed with the black chef who was doing Southern food. And it was really because of Top Chef that I started doing this food that was just calling me. And I think that the food that I wanted to eat, and after I left Top Chef, people are like, oh, you're the Southern chef. Oh, you're the chef who does dessert. And I didn't want to be known as that. But then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This is who I am. And I will unapologetically do this food. And there's no food shaming with me. And I think that anybody coming from some ethnic group, they may go through a little bit of food shaming because their food may be different than what mainstream is. And I think sometimes in this day and age, we want all of this hoity-toity food and foam and everything. And maybe that may be somebody's background, but it isn't mine. And so I'm like, why should I say goodbye or poo-poo my heritage and traditions?
At the time when you were sort of leaving your heritage behind for a moment, who were you trying to be?
French. I mean, I had gone to a French culinary school. As a matter of fact, when my grandmother, who paid for my culinary school, I said to Granny, oh, by the way, Granny, that macaroni and cheese you've been making me all these years, I found out it's broken. What? Dude. So Granny was like, you know, you do not tell a Southern woman that her dish is not right, that you've been eating for all your life. So she got that wooden spoon out and I went popping on my knuckles. So, okay. Not doing that again. You do not do that.
I love that. At what point was it? So it was Top Chef that helped you to make it comfortable to be you. That was really the turning point.
I think so. I think so. It definitely was Top Chef. And so I owe a lot to the Top Chef franchise and to the viewers and to all of the fans who supported me. And because of the fans, I became fan favorite on Top Chef All Stars. And I really think it was because of that. That reason that I was actually invited to audition for the chew.
It's like, ah, all right, people are okay with me being an oddball. Cool.
Right.
It's on. I'm going to be as odd as possible. All right. So my last question for you is, you at 40, it was tough. Now you're doing all sorts of dream jobs. And then so, gosh, if it weren't food, if you sucked at cooking in another life, like what would you be your other dream job?
Wow. Okay. My other thing, the thing that I've always wanted to do, I love crafts. I would have a store with lots of crafts. I love paper. I would want paper there. I want pens. I would want things like all of my favorite things that would be in my store. I would have a store if money was no object and I could lose the money and it's okay. Okay. Because that's a hard business. That's what I would do.
How can we stay in touch with you?
You can stay in touch by following me on Twitter. So that's at Carla Hall. On Instagram, it's Carla P. P is in Patrice Hall. And on Facebook, it's Chef Carla Hall. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Carla.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. I loved it.
Cannot wait to come to your restaurant.
Oh, my God. I cannot wait to finish all of this pizza at what? Roberta's. Thank
Yay.
You.
Heritage Radio Network. You just heard Chef Carla Hall of The Chew, and she's opening up Carla Hall's Southern Kitchen in New York next year. And at the top of the show, we had Adrian Moore, author of Inside Chef's Fridges. Get the book on Amazon.com in case you wanted to look inside of what is essentially a chef's underwear drawer. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks so much to our sound engineer, Liz Smith, with us in the studio today. And happy holidays from the entire Heritage Radio Network family. I'm your host, Leyte Sue. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.